is the world finally getting serious about climate change? Or, to perhaps put it more accurately, are our elites, the world's global leaders, finally getting their act together? Or are we just watching the same old show on repeat? Long on talk, all too short on action. Today we take stock of COP26 and plot out an agenda for radical climate action.
It is not a secret that COP26 is a failure. It should be obvious that we cannot solve a crisis with the same methods that got us into it in the first place.
The tragedy is, this is not a movie. We have not done nearly enough to address this crisis.
The reality of climate change is, it is not something that will happen in the future. It's happening now, it's killing people now, it's destroying the lives and homes and livelihoods of millions and millions of people.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper. Our guest today is Laurie McFarlane from Open Democracy, an economist and fellow at the UCL Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose. We'll be discussing the COP26 conference and mapping the political economy of radical climate transformation. A regular reminder that you can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then, but that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
Laurie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. And before we get started talking about the events in Glasgow and what's going down, what, just on a kind of more stepping back from the conference on a more sort of abstract general basis, could you give us a rundown of what needs to happen in order to keep things below 1.5 degrees? And in that context, what in your dream scenario, your like total ideal, leaving aside all political realism, what would you like to see agreed at COP26?
Well, I mean, a lot of the focus so far and leading up to COP and the way that's transpired has really been focused on targets, you know, setting targets and getting countries to be more ambitious with targets. And, you know, as we might want to talk about, you know, there has been some progress there in terms of pledges and things like that. But I think really what's been missing and is still sorely missing is around sort of concrete action in terms of changes that are actually going to make these targets not just, you know, pipe dream targets that's sort of talking the talk, but actually concrete changes that are going to walk the walk now and fundamentally change, you know, the way that the global economy is working and fundamentally actually shift the dial when it comes to emissions. And I think, you know, for me, in terms of where the sort of big log jams are or what you really need to see progress on, I think fundamentally it is about changes that we'll see basically a change of direction from countries in the global north that will then enable other countries around the world to enable these changes that we need to see to happen. Because fundamentally at the moment, you know, we have this, you know, big problem that's basically a sort of massive collective action problem. And we have this sort of deep sense of injustice and mistrust at the heart of that, particularly, you know, as I said, between countries in the global north who are predominantly responsible for the climate crisis and those in the global south who are in many cases on the front line and suffering the consequences from that. And I think really, if we're going to make progress on anything in terms of getting close to meeting our objectives, we need to see some real change in attitudes and mechanisms from countries in the global north basically to sort of get things moving. And one of the biggest disappointments for me so far has been, we had last week this discussion around it, but even before COP started, it became apparent that, you know, the £100 billion a year that was pledged back in Paris of support to countries in the Global South hasn't been met and probably won't be met until 2023. And I think this really sort of encapsulates a lot of what is wrong. Firstly, because that target in itself wasn't met, but that was, you know, grossly inadequate in all kinds of ways. First of all, it's nowhere near enough. And secondly, I think what people don't realise is that figure, it's often reported, the way it's reported in the media, as if it's sort of aid or charity. And actually, it's repayable loans with interest for the most part. And so this is, again, sort of loans being extended to countries, often whom are, you know, drowning in debt already, that need to be repaid. And so in terms of what I would like to see, and really, and I think this sort of is the key to unlocking progress, you know, elsewhere, is a sort of a new settlement, if you like, for a sort of properly ambitious, bold global Green New Deal that not only sort of brings our global economic system in sustainable limits, but also does so in a way that's just. And that's not going to happen unless we see, you know, a completely different attitude towards both financial and non-financial support to enable countries to actually deliver on the things that we need to see. And so moving away from repayable loans to things like, you know, unconditional grants, debt cancellation, tech transfers, and that kind of thing. And I think the best is from UNCTAD, which is the UN Conference on Trade and Development, which is the kind of part of the UN that's you know, actually quite good. And they were calling for £500 billion of a sort of global Marshall Plan, if you like, of basically grants that can help sort of kickstart that global Green New Deal, significant levels of debt cancellation, but not just sort of burdening countries with new loans, but actually sort of looking at writing off some of the debts off of many of them unjust that have been, you know, piled up today. And actually, once we get these sorts of agreement mechanisms in place, and that starts to rebuild a sense of, yeah, that mistrust that we're seeing at the moment, that's basically being the logjam in the system, because countries are rightly saying, well, hold on a minute, we're being expected to, you know, we haven't benefited from, you know, the much of the wealth that's been accumulated from fossil fuel-based economy. We're now being asked to, you know, do all this stuff by the rich countries who are responsible for this, and we're basically being provided with absolutely, you know, minimal financial support to do that. And also, by the way, countries like the UK, the US and Europe, you're also, you know, you're also still very much part of the problem in the way that you're conducting things at home. So, yeah, I would like to see that much more bolder sort of settlement on deal, if you like, between countries like the US, Europe, the UK, et cetera, and countries in the Global South. Because as long as we don't see that radical shift in attitudes and we see this current sort of the way that we're moving along just now prevail, then I think that targets, however much, you know, they might make us feel good, they don't really mean anything unless they're accompanied by actual change on the ground. And again, I don't think we're going to see anything like that until we change, you know, the way that the global economy is working.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the money, one of Monday's announcements, which was probably one of the most disappointing, was the UK government, Boris Johnson, saying that it was going to put £290 million into development aid for sustainable development projects in the Global South. And in UK government spending terms, that is a derisory amount of money. I mean, I know for Joe Bloggs on the Street, all of these sums always sound far beyond what we can comprehend in terms of our day-to-day spending. But in UK public spending terms, £290 million is really next to nothing. And I noticed that in the last financial year, 2020 to 2021, the UK spent £2.5 billion on consultants, some of which were earning thousands of pounds as individuals per day. So it's not quite, but nearly 10 times as much money in the last financial year spent on consultants to firms like PricewaterhouseCoopers and others. It is incredibly mean, no?
It is. And I mean, when you look at, I mean, some of the numbers that have been thrown around have either been, you know, incredibly, you know, almost farcical in terms of how how poor they are compared to what's needed. But then on the other end of the scale, we've had, you know, last week we had Rishi Sunak throwing around the figure of saying we've got this 130 trillion pool of what they called pool of cash in the global financial system that's sort of ready and waiting to fund the net zero transition, which is obviously, you know, first of all, it's a farcical number, because what that represents is 40% of all of the financial assets that currently exist in the world, most of which are far from green. But what the Chancellor had, or Mark Carney, who he's had working on this, have managed to do is to get 40% of the owners of these assets to kind of vaguely say that at some point, you know, in the future, they plan to sort of green their operations. But again, it's meaningless. And I think that claim of 130 trillion, it's so outlandish and it's so large that it just isn't helpful at all, because, you know, we're having this debate, as I said, about the 100 billion a year pledged in Paris not being met, and that not being enough. And then for Rishi Sunak to come along and say, oh, actually, don't worry, there's 130 trillion of cash sloshing around, you know, ready to go. It's just, you know, it's just not helpful one bit. And it's also just highly, highly misleading, to be honest. And you know, for people, you know, reading that, paying attention, saying, hold on, you know, why are we arguing about this 100 billion when there's 130 trillion out there? You know, it's deeply misleading. And I think, you know, many of the figures that have been thrown around so far at COP, they've either been, you know, completely inadequate or very misleading.
To try to be a little bit more optimistic, I noticed that some academics at Imperial College came out and crunched some numbers on their predictions. Now, leaving aside that pledges is not enough and we need policies, so of course that's absolutely right, it was quite interesting what they said, because they actually found that under pledges made at the 2015 Paris Agreement, the chances of limiting temperature change to below 2 degrees C and 1.5 degrees C were 8% and 0% respectively. So it was just extremely unlikely, if you'd taken just the pledges that were made at the 2015 conference, that we were going to get below 2 degrees, and there was no chance of getting below 1.5 degrees. Now, when they came to the pledges made this time round, they now estimate that there's about a 1 in 3 chance of staying below 2 degrees, and there's close to non-existent, but not quite non-existent, 1.5% chance of staying below 1.5 degrees. So it on paper, at least in terms of their calculations, they think some of these pledges could make quite a big difference. What's your thought?
Yeah, I agree in the sense that, you know, the pledges are progress, but this kind of sums up, I think, where we're at, because the debate has moved on since we were, you know, at Paris, in the sense that we are now, you know, countries are now talking the talk. They are now, or at least not all of them, but at least, you know, many that weren't are putting out net zero targets, that are putting out pledges saying that, you know, we are now, you know, saying that we're going to, you know, decarbonize over a set time frame. But again, you know, and that's great, but again, it's a kind of a snail's pace compared to what's needed if it's not accompanied by, you know, realistic, concrete, you know, policy changes on the ground in terms of how this is going to be delivered. And so it is progress. And I think, you know, there is a risk that we all, you know, fall into, you know, doomism and are too negative on this. But I think, you know, it's important to highlight at the same time that, you know, reinforce the point that pledges, you know, are not necessarily, you know, it's basically saying we're going to deliver something at some point in the future, and often it's in the quite distant future, and that while to be celebrated as progress, you know, is not the same as delivering on that. And I think now we do need to be looking much more concretely at the delivery side of things in order to push progress there. Otherwise, it will just be, you know, words without action.
How much do you think that the manifestations of climate change becoming so obvious in many places is to do with this shift amongst elites? I mean, Australia, I think, is quite an interesting country here. I mean, it's one of the world's, well, it is the world's biggest exporter of coal, but it's also one of the biggest victims of climate change, those appalling bushfires. We saw a 2019-2020 bushfire season decade before they were similarly as bad in 2009. So it's a major victim of climate change. And it also seems to be almost pugnaciously anti the climate change agenda. And 10 or 15 years ago, there was it was sort of this kind of common sense view that Anthony Giddens is quite associated with in his book on climate change. But it's basically just common sense. So this widely circulating view was that, well, the big problem with climate change is we don't see its effects. So once we see the effects, it will be too late to act. But that Australia and other instances where climate change is becoming, you know, so apparent, the floods in Germany, you know, over the summer being another case, that seems to like confound that sort of common sense hypothesis from 10 or 15 years ago.
Something that definitely is happening here is, you know, even since Paris, the effects of climate change have become, you know, much, much more apparent across the world. And sometimes, you know, you do have that happening in, you know, in Australia, as you point out, also the US. I mean, Canada is another interesting one. You know, we had the Canadian election earlier this year, and it seemed to be the case, watching from afar anyway, that climate did begin, you know, in the latter stages of the election to kind of become more of a political issue than it had been. And part of that was because, you know, Canada has had all kinds of extreme weather. And I think Canada was at one point, parts of Canada were the hottest place in the world at one point this year, which is not obviously what you're used to seeing in Canada. But at the same time, you know, as you point out, we do have, you know, many countries like, you know, Australia being, you know, an obvious, you know, big example here, you know, which has been devastated by things like wildfires, but at the same time, really being one of the most problematic countries when it comes to climate action. You know, Australia set out a net zero pledge, and this kind of highlights the problem with pledges, as we were talking about, set out a net zero pledge, but made it clear that, you know, it's going to continue to, you know, be one of the biggest exporters of fossil fuels, and that it's not going to account for that in its pledge. And so, yeah, it's deeply frustrating. But clearly, you know, as I mentioned before, many of the places that are really suffering the most from climate change are countries in the global south. And this isn't necessarily something that's just started happening, you know, this year, last year. This has been happening, you know, for a long time now. But too often, you know, the voices aren't being heard or are being completely ignored from the debate.
On the subject of Australia coming out against the coal pledge, very explicitly against, Poland came out in favour, but they said that only by 2049, and they said it was consistent with their previous statements. Poland is also has massive coal mines, big coal producer. Boris Johnson put a lot of store in political capital in advance of getting an agreement on coal. What's your sense of how important that pledge is?
If we're going to come close to doing this, then phasing out coal is clearly an urgent priority, and in many ways the bare minimum. There's been a lot of discussion around, you know, countries like India and China not signing up to this, but, you know, the US didn't sign up to it either, you know, and you know, I said Australia as well. And so clearly it's, you know, it's nowhere near at the level that it needs to be. But again, I think you will have countries, particularly, you know, poorer countries elsewhere in the world, you know, it's easy to sort of criticize them. But when we have countries like the US also not signing up, you know, that kind of massive failure of, you know, leadership from countries, the US in this case, you know, more responsible than any other for the climate crisis, not signing up to this kind of stuff, then, you know, the moral argument to sort of criticize other countries is much more difficult.
And I noticed on Twitter as well that you were keen to point out that you thought the Indian pledge on 2070, I think it was, for net zero, was actually quite significant.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's important just to have some perspective on this, because there was a lot of sneering, you know, particularly in the UK commentary and elsewhere about this when this happened, saying, oh, India's come out with net zero by 2070. That's 20 years after the UK is saying, you know, this is out of order. They're really not pulling their weight here. And I think part of this is just, you know, perspective on emissions. You know, India even today has, you know, very low per capita emissions compared to Western countries. And if you look historically in terms of cumulative emissions over time per person, the UK's is 18 times higher than India's. And so clearly you know, to the extent to which the climate crisis is, you know, as I said before, we have the wealthy countries of the global north have basically gobbled up most of the world's carbon budget and leaving little room for countries like India to be able to develop. I think the idea that we should look at or expect countries like India to, you know, be committing to net zero on the same time frame as countries like the UK, I think is, you know, is unrealistic and is unfair. And also, in, you know, I think India's pledge was significant in terms of progress, because a year ago, I don't think really anyone was really expecting India to announce a net zero target at COP. And so I think this, it is significant in that sense, in that it's probably, you know, better than was expected. And there was also, I mean, the 2070 thing is the thing that got the headlines, but also India committed to generating half of its energy by renewable sources by 2030, which is also significant. There are also other things in there around electrifying rail and things like that. And so, yeah, so when you look at it in the sort of broader context, you know, in some ways, India's target is actually kind of more ambitious than, you know, the UK's 2050 target, I would argue, and when you look at things all together. And clearly all countries, including India, including the UK, need to be doing more. But yeah, I don't think we should sort of trivialise that commitment from India and how big a thing that is for India, and also how, you know, how challenging it will be for them to achieve.
Brexit has happened, and many of the things we warned about are coming true, but no one seems to want to talk about it. Here at Another Europe, we say it's time for meaningful accountability and real scrutiny. And that's where our new project, Brexit Spotlight, comes in. We're breaking the silence and shining a light on the calamities. Find out more at brexitspotlight.org. In a way, lots of countries in the global south are going to need to skip the industrial phase of civilization, if you like. I suppose if you, or what I mean by that is, if you look at a country like Somalia, where there's a real debate at the moment in Somalia about tapping its potential as an off-sea oil producer, and a completely understandable, you know, impulse and debate for the country's elite and population to have, because, you know, you look across the Gulf and you see that vast effect that oil has had on Gulf oil producing nations in terms of their wealth and national development. Yeah, why can't Somalia have some of that? And so I suppose, does the whole climate change question mean we have to think differently about development? You know, Marxists have been guilty of this in the past, of thinking that there was this stage and then you move to the next stage and then you move to the next stage. There's a liberal version of this, which is like modernization theory, where you have agricultural society, then you have industrial society, then you have a service economy, and so on. Doesn't climate change come in and kind of problematize that view of development? And if it does, what does development start to, or what do we want development to start to look like, if it's going to be both ecologically sustainable and able to achieve egalitarian social justice based outcomes?
The question of what, you know, sustainable development, or whatever you want to call it, looks like, it's clearly not the trajectory that the industrialized advanced economies of the world today have been through, because ultimately it's that trajectory and model of development that over the course of the past, you know, century, two centuries, however long, is really responsible for the crisis that we face today. And so the idea that, you know, other countries, that's a sort of desirable path to be following, you know, clearly that's not the case. But at the same time, absolutely, we want and desperately need to see, you know, living standards, you know, increase dramatically in lots of the world, and prosperity to be, you know, delivered. And so that means the question is that, yeah, that's completely different than what we've seen before. And particularly, you know, crucially, it can't be based on fossil fuels. And ultimately, I think a lot of this is around the sort of, comes down to the sort of energy basis for an economy. I think there are also opportunities for prosperity to be, you know, to be had in a, you know, of a completely different kind, that can be based on clean energy that can be based on different sorts of economic activity that isn't extractive.
And there's also this argument that particular types of energy production are more conducive to egalitarian outcomes than other types, isn't there? So I know that a lot of the post-capitalist literature, which is really interested in the commons, something Paul Mason's written about, is interested in this idea that as costs come down and renewable energies are extremely cheap, it points towards more collective outcomes, but also has this effect that it doesn't have as strong incentives for capitalist investment as renewable energy. So there does seem, I don't know if you agree, but it does seem to be a kind of relationship between particular types of energy production and also their kind of the social relations, if to put it in a very Marxist way, that surround them.
I think that's true to a certain extent, but I think it's important to kind of caution this little bit, because there is the idea as well that the whole, when you look at fossil fuels, the whole sort of social relations underpinning that, but also not the fact that this is based around the extraction of raw materials that are centralized in particular locations, whereas renewable energy is basically dispersed. The wind blows everywhere, the sun shines everywhere, and therefore could be harnessed in a way that is sort of much more dispersed and potentially egalitarian. At the same time as that, though, I think we do need to remember that while renewable energy itself, or sources of it, i.e. the wind and the sun, is sort of dispersed, the materials needed to actually harness that renewable energy actually does bear many of the characteristics of fossil fuels, if you like, in the sense of, if you look at things like iron, copper, lithium, cobalt, all the things that you needed to, not only build your solar panels or your wind turbines, but also actually crucially sort of battery technology that we need to make that work on a global scale. These are minerals or metals that are based, in the ground in certain parts of the world. And so in that sense, I think, what the shift to renewable energy does, it doesn't necessarily have by itself that sort of dramatic, doesn't automatically come with it that sort of dramatic shift in the sort of social relations underpinning it. I think it shifts the sort of strategic imperative of capital from securing supplies of fossil fuels to securing the raw materials required to harness renewable energy. And I think there's obviously an important geopolitical dynamic to this, because part of the fossil fuel age, if you like, part of that and the geopolitics around that was, major powers, focusing on areas like the Middle East, et cetera, to ensure access to fossil fuels. And I think what we're going to see, and I think we're already seeing, is that sort of geopolitical imperative shift towards, other places in Africa, et cetera, where the resources of things like cobalt and lithium are. And yeah, so I think it's a little bit dangerous to assume that by itself, the shift to renewable energy will sort of automatically deliver a more egalitarian economic system. I don't think it will by itself unless it's fought for, because I can see a world, unfortunately, if we're complacent about this, where, we can move to a clean-ish energy system that does sort of retain the many of the sort of political and economic configurations we have today and all the inequalities that entails.
We've seen at the moment spiraling costs of oil and gas. It's really having an impact on household bills here in the UK and all across Europe. And at a most basic level, it must mean that those rising prices will incentivize investments in industries, which, strategically speaking, at COP, we have to see reduce in size quite significantly. So is there a danger at the moment, and some quite, pernicious neoliberals have even come out and said, well, look, this is the danger of the net zero stuff. If you want really high oil and gas prices forever, or if you want to avoid that, we need to be investing in fossil fuels to bring down those prices. So what do you think about that nexus of issues?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's clearly, a massive issue and a massive risk. I mean, we had the sort of irony, really, in the weeks running up to COP, we had many countries ramping up coal production. We had the UK actually ramp up energy generation from coal due to the gas price crisis. We had leaders sort of asking or encouraging OPEC to increase oil production, all the kind of things, the opposite of what we really need to see. And I think that's clearly a sort of step backwards. And I do think the risk here, though, is, as you point out, you know, where is the, what is seen as the problem here? What's seen as the cause here? Because we have seen many people jump on this to say, oh, well, this is, as you say, the inevitable result of these net zero targets. So this is a result of, you know, trying to rely on flimsy renewables rather than actually putting the blame where it should lie, which is this is the problem of having an energy system that is relying on, you know, fossil fuels of oil and gas. And clearly in the short term, because, you know, countries, you know, we aren't where we need to be in terms of moving to a different energy system yet, countries have therefore had to be sort of rapidly, desperately trying to source, you know, fossil fuels or invest in fossil fuel capacity, whether that's oil, whether that's gas, etc. And you see that in the UK, you see people say, oh, well, we should have gone big on fracking, because if we did, we wouldn't be in this place. And so, yeah, it's a massive issue. And I do think as well, what this to me at least highlights is the problem of relying on the sort of price mechanism here as a means of making that transition, you know, to a sustainable economy. Because fundamentally, I think we need to, rather than relying on pricing, we need to see much more robust, you know, regulation and, you know, command and control measures to basically, you know, we need to acknowledge basically there are large parts of our existing economic system, you know, whether that's fossil fuels, whether that's unsustainable agriculture, or frankly, whether it's even in things like goods like probably SUVs and private jets, there are parts of our economic system today that are simply incompatible with, you know, a sustainable economy and a planet that lives within its ecological means.
A number of people have been pointing out recently and for a while the implications of the green transition for our financial system might really be quite significant. And I don't mean here people with vested interests, but more critical observers, just looking at the financial system, looking at our oil and gas industries and saying, well, what happens here to this system without any structural change if we move successfully away from fossil fuels? Well, the obvious basic outcome is that all of the oil held in oil reserves becomes what green activists have called stranded assets that become worthless. And so you have this huge $1 trillion worth of industry will suddenly devalue overnight. And that's something that happens in economic crises when capitalists wake up one day and realize that their assets are not worth what they thought they were worth. And of course, as we know, the effects of economic crisis often aren't borne by capitalists. So how do we need to deal with that? It seems that we need to be talking about really quite far-reaching and radical reform, and including, as you suggest, questions of almost planning, state ownership, etc., of our financial system. And clearly the political debate, even if it's improving a bit, is really quite far away from that, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is something where we have started to see this global, you know, financial regulators and central banks start to kind of wake up to this a bit, and in the UK and elsewhere. So the extent to which central banks, for example, are starting to take an interest in you know, the role of central banking in climate, it really is in this sense of seeing climate risks as a sort of potential source of, you know, systemic risk to global financial systems or financial fragility at some point. Because, as you say, if you look at the assets on many of the world's largest financial institutions, they are inherently tied up in fossil fuels and in fossil fuel development. Of course, that's because they've been lending to these things over many, many years when it's quite apparent that shouldn't have been happening. And so, yeah, we are in this situation now where there is a potential spillover effect here of, if we do make a rapid transition, which we need to do, to a sustainable global economy, then the ripple effects through the global financial system could be quite severe. And as you say, it's often those who can afford at least who end up suffering the most from that. And so we do absolutely need to be thinking about this. We've seen some tepid steps from financial regulators, you know, discussing about, well, how can we ensure the debate at the moment is basically focused on how can we ensure that financial institutions are basically protected from these risks. So should they be made, for example, to hold a little bit more capital, you know, to account for the risks of these things? And I think it is at the moment it's at very early stages and it's nowhere near where it needs to be, because ultimately, as you say, if we are going to anything like, never mind 1.5 degrees, or never mind that, but 2 degrees, the pace and the scale upon which we're going to need to see changes, that is going to have a significant impact on the financial system. And so, yeah, things like, you know, economic planning, you know, public ownership, all this kind of stuff absolutely needs to be, you know, a crucial part of the debate. And the other issue here is that, you know, I said that the way that regulators are looking at this problem at the moment is kind of how can we protect the financial system from the climate. What we're not doing and seeing enough of is how do we protect the planet from the activities of financial institutions, because these financial institutions, many of them are very much part of the problem at the moment rather than part of the solution. And the way that you hear COP, you know, policymakers last week and Rishi Sunak sort of very much talking up the financial sector as, you know, a very much part of the solution here about how they've got, there's all this money that can be used to fund net zero. The reality is that, you know, large parts of the financial sector are still financing, whether it's fossil fuel projects or other things that really need to stop straight away. And so we also need to be looking, well, how do we rein in, how do we stop this type of financing, that a financial sector that fundamentally is contributing to the problem? And this needs much more robust interventions, much more robust measures, both regulatory and other, to basically stop them from making the problem even worse than it already is.
Is there a danger with a lot of the language around the Green New Deal, which is a bit big is beautiful sometimes, perhaps, really big investment? Does it take away from the need to conserve and reuse resources? I'm thinking here some of the ideas that are put forward around circular economy, making sure that we do more with less, and also in relation to energy production as well, notwithstanding the issues with supply chains that we've discussed. There is an opportunity with renewables to source energy much more locally. So there seems to be a kind of inherent tension in some ways between the kind of planning aspect of the vision and the local community self-government kind of aspect of a new green economy.
I think I'd agree to some extent. I think there is a danger where that sort of leads into the narrative around saying, you know, and you know, individuals or individual behavioral change, you know, can, you know, that's a sort of path that can, you know, offer some of the solutions that we need. And I think reality is that although clearly there are things that can happen at a local level, there are clearly you know, individual sort of projects or measures that people can take that are going to do some good. I think really the things that we do need to see change, if we are going to really make a difference on the scale that's needed, is the sort of upstream measures at the level of our systems, and things that will basically help reduce people's carbon footprint, you know, whether individuals are willing to change their lifestyles, you know, or not. So that does inherently require that sort of systems level change, whether that's in energy, whether that's in transport, whether that's in other things, to then enable people to, you know, to do things. And even things like you mentioned, the circular economy here, you know, there's clearly legal changes that really could do a lot to help accelerate the circular economy around the right to reuse and repair and recycle. You know, we have at the moment, for example, I think there's a discussion happening at the EU level just now to basically make it mandatory for companies to offer advanced sort of repair services than they currently do. But also, you know, if you look at things like iPhones, for example, which Apple basically say, if you want to repair your iPhone, you need to come to us to do it. Otherwise, you know, if they say that you've went somewhere else, it's not the official Apple store to get something fixed, then they basically sort of cut you off. I do agree generally, but I do think, you know, it's we always want to be pushing back against the idea that, you know, voluntary, you know, individual change at the local level is enough to do this, because really it is a systems level problem.
In the UK, we have the specific problem compared to the rest of Europe, I think, that all the things that should be cheap are really expensive, and all the things that should be expensive are really cheap. I'm thinking here the extraordinary contrast between domestic flights that we've just had a tax incentive on in the last budget, and trains in the UK that are just at an utterly astronomical cost.
Yeah, definitely. It's we have, in many ways, we have things backwards, and that's why, you know, as I was saying, it does make things very difficult for people, even, you know, with all the goodwill in the world, who really want to do the right thing. Often when it comes to the crunch, you know, because of the way things are structured and the way, we have things backwards and the way things are priced, ultimately it is difficult. And that's the same in transport. It's the same in often it's the same in our food system and various other places. And so, as I say, by making the sort of upstream systems level changes, that then means that actually, you know, it means that everyone can start to make these decisions, not just those who are, you know, willing to, but also, you know, economically comfortable enough that they're happy to pay a bit more to do the right thing, because many people just don't have that luxury, you know.
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms, but the discussion isn't over. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, I talk to Laurie about the UK's corruption problem and place it in the context of the rise of authoritarian capitalism. It's a good chat. If you want to listen to it, you just need to sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. You can join at anothereurope.org/join. It doesn't cost much at all and makes a big difference.